live from Television City in Hollywood.
Television popularity took off in the early 1950s, several years before the technology needed to record and edit programs was fully developed. As a result, almost all of the early shows, including complex dramas, had to be broadcast live. A collection of 8 of those shows have just been released by the Criterion Collection in a DVD set called The Golden Age of Television, and joining me now to talk about it is Ron Simon, a curator at the Paley Center for Media and author of the liner notes for the DVD set. Welcome to our show.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Some of these dramas are familiar, even though they were only shown once in the 1950s and then a second time on PBS in the early 1980s. If the technology didn't exist to record these dramas for later broadcast, how were they recorded?
Well, it was called the kinescope process, and they had a film projector shoot off the television monitor so that you have all the imperfections of the monitor. But that was the best record we had. But I should say most of these dramas were so compelling, characters so rich, that they were later made into a feature film. So a lot of people think they've seen Marty, but they haven't seen the original Marty. They saw the Marty with Ernest Borgnine.
Not the one with Rod Steiger.
Exactly.
Who was a pretty great actor, too. How good is the quality of the shows in the set?
Well, they're black and white. It's an old style of television, but the quality really doesn't matter. It's the story, it's the characters that really fascinate you. And it just shows that if you've got a good script and you've got a writer and a good director behind it, the quality really doesn't matter.
Now, they became famous at the time, but when you were a young researcher for NBC, didn't you come upon the original recordings of these dramas collecting dust in a New Jersey warehouse?
Exactly. I was working on NBC's 50th anniversary show. We were looking for some of the great highlights of NBC history. These kinescopes were just sitting there. There was no reason for NBC to reuse them. They had never thought that they would have any value whatsoever. I'm just so glad they sat on the shelf as opposed to a lot of kinescopes that were destroyed.
So they must have known that these were special.
Well, you know, I don't know.
Were these the more critically acclaimed ones?
These were certainly the critically acclaimed. I think they kept the primetime shows. So much of, we'll say, the Today Show or the Tonight Shows, they were destroyed from the 50s, but they kept the primetime schedule more than any other show.
When I started here, this radio operation was a lot smaller, and we would reuse tape. So who knows what has disappeared over the years. We only saved the things that we thought we might have to save for posterity. An awful lot of great shows were totally recorded over.
Well, that's the good thing about film. Tape, actually, the era of tape, late 60s, early 70s, the tapes were reused, so programs were lost that way. Film, you have to physically destroy it. So that film was much more of a survivor, I would think, than the early days of videotape.
Well, we're talking about really important people involved in these shows. Marty was written by Paddy Chayefsky, directed by Delbert Mann. Requiem for a Heavyweight was written by Rod Serling, directed by Ralph Nelson. The Comedian was also written by Rod Serling, directed by John Frankenheimer. But as you say, we're more familiar with them because they became celebrated at the time and then were adapted into movies?
Well, here's the one thing. When you mention these great names, Frankenheimer and Chayefsky, Serling, we think of them as legends now. They had long careers for the most part. Back then, they were young men grappling with society using this new technology. They weren't legends. They were just trying to make it. And they're trying to understand what was happening to America in this post-war society. And I think you feel that, especially today, more than anything else than legendary classic shows. I think you feel the vigor of now.
But since they are also television dramas, they take place in the intersection of the theater and modern made-for-TV shows. How aware were the viewers that they were watching something that was being broadcast live?
You know, it was a crazy era. Can you believe that these dramas were singular events? They were made just to be seen one night only. And that was it. They were going to disappear. So it put a great demand, especially on the writer, to create something that would attract the interest from the very beginning and impel the viewer to see it throughout.
Well, the dramas don't have the awkward look that I associate with some film stage plays. They were really inventing a new way to film here?
You know, they were discovering new ways. It was a new technology, a new way to think about a new medium. And people like John Frankenheimer were creating the most elaborate camera work that you've ever seen. And most of these great creators would take those ideas and those inspirations to feature film, where you could spend a little bit more time.
But in the feature films at that time, you shot everything with one camera, and then you edited everything together. Here, they were often shooting with three cameras, weren't they?
Using three cameras, and it was just in the control room cutting from one camera to the next. But you almost had to be a military strategist to know exactly what camera you wanted and what was going to get that close-up. The close-up was so important in these dramas.
They had to block them out. Didn't some actors sometimes need to run between the studios during commercial breaks?
Well, there was the logistics of putting these live dramas on were just so daunting. And when you get someone like a Frankenheimer who were creating shots, if you look at that first shot of the comedian, you would say, how could that be done live? It was so complex. And then you had a quirky lead character like Mickey Rooney, so that everything was a major, major event.
One person involved in one of the dramas said it was like doing summer stock in an iron lung.
That is John Frankenheimer. And we did a lot with Frankenheimer at the Paley Center. And he was just one of the most imaginative fellows. And, you know, he was one of the inspirations of the Golden Age.
Well, he goes on to having an incredible career in films, and so do some of these others. We see a young Paul Newman in Bang the Drum Slowly, a young Andy Griffin in No Time for Sergeants, a young Elizabeth Montgomery in Patterns.
It is amazing. These actors are not known, but they're given one great shot, one starring role. We'll say Paul Newman in Bang the Drum, and the camera just lingers on him. He's sort of your guide in this drama, and you can just feel the presence of an actor that you want to know more about.
Now, they started doing these original dramas because they had already used up an awful lot of public domain material.
Yeah, they did Shakespeare, they did Edgar Allan Poe, but suddenly it was Fred Coe, one of the great producers in live drama, who said, we need original voices. Let's see what's happening in today's society. And then starting with Patajewski and his iconic character Marty, you have a whole series of writers just grappling with contemporary society, critiquing where we're headed.
Did that set a tone? Because Marty has very naturalistic dialogue.
I think that Marty really said that you can deal with contemporary life, and Chayefsky wanted to wiretap dialogue as if you're just hearing it from the streets. And I think he created a whole different dialogue that was so different from Tennessee Williams, Arthur Miller. It was great for the method actor, and you felt like these were actually people in your living room.
It was shown on May 1953, so we're talking about pretty early. Maybe we can listen to a little clip.
What do you feel like doing tonight?
I don't know. What do you feel like doing tonight?
We're back to that, huh? I say to you, what do you feel like doing tonight? And you say back to me, I don't know. What do you feel like doing tonight? Then we wind up sitting around your house with a couple of cans of beer watching Sid Caesar on television.
And that what do you want to do tonight, Marty, became a cliche at the time.
It was a cliche, but it's great because it's just repetition of dialogue, not non sequiturs, but it really captured the way people speak. And I think that was why so many people identified with Marty. And the one thing about Marty also is that Chayefsky is looking at how contemporary culture, people like Mickey Spillane, are changing the whole idea of manhood and masculinity. And that's what Marty is in flux. He doesn't know who he is and what he should be doing.
Why didn't Rod Steiger get the part when it was made into a film?
You know, it took a few years, and it went through many different iterations. Steiger wasn't available, and he was sort of the epitome of a method actor, had to sink himself into the role. You get someone totally the opposite, Ernest Borgnine. But the thing about the dialogue is that even Borgnine, who's an exterior actor, could deliver it, and it felt real from him, totally the opposite of Rod Steiger.
The TV show also featured Nancy Marchand, who had a very long career, Broadway and TV, and was playing Tony Soprano's mother when she died in the year 2000.
Yeah, she plays a school teacher struggling with herself, and it's interesting to see this early role, and then you think of where Nancy Marchand went, especially in those final years as Tony's mother.
Since these things were done live, did they have any idea of how long they were going to run? Did they always hit their posts and get out exactly on time?
Well, they rehearsed these live dramas for about 3 weeks, and they knew exactly how long a drama would be. It was 52 minutes. Then it had the commercials for the most part done live. So they became masters certainly of timing and promptness. And that's one thing that Frankenheimer especially mentioned. He knew exactly how long a scene would take.
Although I've heard that sometimes the credits would get cut off and people right. who really were waiting for that credit to help them in their careers would be very disappointed.
You could sacrifice the credits, but not the story. The story was the crucial element.
Requiem for a Heavyweight was the first drama to run for 90 minutes. Until then, hadn't TV executives believed that a program wouldn't hold viewers' attention for more than an hour?
Well, actually, the storytellers themselves, the writers, thought that the hour was the perfect time for television. And that, they thought that was the epitome of the art form of live television. And with Requiem, Playhouse 90 created a whole new form, the 90-minute drama. It was also different. It was from Hollywood, and it was being done in studios built for television production. The studios done, we'll say, for Marty back in New York, they were very small, cramped, and you really got that sense of this interior drama. Things became a little bit more lavish when live television production moved to Los Angeles.
My guest is Ron Simon, who's a curator at the Paley Center for Media, author of the liner notes for the DVD set that we're talking about called The Golden Age of Television. And one critic called the liner notes worth the price of the DVD set, which is a real compliment, but it would be sad if people didn't watch the shows as well.
Well, I tried to give an understanding, a context of what this 50s live television was about.
And it's interesting that so many of these shows had the names of the sponsors as part of their names. The Goodyear Television Playhouse, Kraft Television Theater, the U.S. Steel Hour, the Hallmark Hall of Fame.
Well, that's how television was underwritten in those days. It was not a series of sponsors buying into a show. It was one sponsor creating an anthology drama in which individual dramas could be slotted in on a weekly basis.
Have you seen any evidence of the sponsors affecting the content of the shows?
Well, they begin, you know, certainly very early on. One of the great stories is that there's going to be and Jim Sheldon, director, was telling me this. He was doing an adaptation of a Kipling work called The Light That Failed. And General Electric was the sponsor, and they don't want to be identified with lights failing, so they changed the title of it to The Gathering Night. So all of those little compromises happened, and as time went on, it really became an imposition on the writer, especially Rod Serling, who had enough. And that's why he went from live television anthology drama to The Twilight Zone. He said, you can't interfere with Martians. Mm-hmm. But you can with real-life characters that he created in live television.
This is also occurring during the McCarthy era,
yes,
and a time when people were very aware of censorship, also who could be hired and who couldn't. Do we see the impact of that on
Well, certainly
shows?
There are a lot of actors that were on the list or slightly on the list. Someone like Kim Hunter from Requiem for a Heavyweight, questioned, but they were able to work because they brought something to these live dramas.
Also, are we talking about the difference between Hollywood and New York until it all got moved out to California?
Yeah, certainly New York has a theater tradition, and especially now post-war, you have a new acting style, the method acting that James Dean and Marlon Brando brought to all media. And many of the actors were trying to use this new technique and delve into the character. And I think that's why the New York dramas were so exciting. You have a Steiger, and you have so many others like James Dean.
Well, in the case of Requiem for Heavyweight, you have an all-star cast. Jack Palance as the washed-up boxer, Kim Hunter as his employment counselor, Keenan Wynn and his father, Edwin, all in the cast. Let's listen to a little clip.
But I got no special problems. You see, there wasn't any room down on that cheek, but I was almost a heavyweight champion of the world. I'm a big, ugly slob, and I look like a freak, but I was almost a heavyweight. You know, I'd like to put that down on that piece of paper. This is no punk. This is a guy who is almost a heavyweight champion of the world.
That almost sounds like an influence on the waterfront. I could have been a contender.
Right. And the thing about Requiem, it's so much like the wrestler, Mickey Rourke character. What does it mean to be washed up in this society? That's what Serling wanted to know. And the whole idea of live drama, you hear the, I'm in a big, ugly slob. I mean, Marty has a little bit of that. The question is, what is every man in American society? And that's what the writers wanted to know.
How long after this did they stop doing these live broadcasts?
Well, 1960 is sort of the end, that the anthology dramas end. There's some live specials. Certainly Hallmark Hall of Fame continued the tradition. But by 1960, most of the directors and writers were moving into feature film. And let's face it, television learned that audiences like continuing characters. They prefer the icons, Lucy and Jackie Gleason, more than the individual drama. So television, I think, recognized what popular taste was.
Well, we're going to be doing a segment in a little while with people who believe that the last decade has been a golden age of television. But we're talking about a very different sense of what television is all about and what its potential is all about.
Well, it's a whole different medium, the whole idea of live TV. And that's the one thing I like about this box set. I've read many of the reviews, for the most part, younger reviewers who did not know about live television in the 50s, and they were really impelled to think about what's happening this decade, what happened last decade. And I have to give credit to especially Matt Weiner, creator of Mad Men, because he said that he really wanted to bring Serling and Chayefsky back into a series. And I think that people have felt more about the golden age this decade because of shows like Mad Men, because they're so well-written and crafted. And I really like the argument. That's a great argument. When was the golden age, if we ever had one?
Did things go wrong during these live broadcasts? I assume they did.
I mean, they
people
always did
forgot
for
lines and
yeah,
stuff.
Yeah, you can see it. But they knew how to cover, you know, there were always, you know, props that failed, extras that would sneak in. But these eight dramas, nothing went wrong. They were sort of the perfection of the form.
And we've been talking about a few of them, but we forgot to mention Days of Wine and Roses, a pretty good one with Cliff Robertson and Piper Laurie.
It's a great one because you're dealing with this upwardly mobile middle-class couple that then succumbs to alcohol. And what does addiction mean when this, you know, really nice-looking couple begins to fall downward? Again, it's television drama exploring all the problems that are just sort of creeping in to American society.
And what are some of the other ones that we should be looking at?
Well, you know, also, Song from the South has one of the great actresses of live television, Julie Harris. She was in so many great dramas, and it's a very quiet, compelling drama that really looks inside this young Gaelic waitress.
Ron Simon is the curator at the Paley Center for Media, author of the liner notes for a new DVD set from Criterion called The Golden Age of Television. Thank you so much for being with us
today. Well, thank you, and enjoy the 50s, but take a look at today, too.